Welcome, welcome, welcome. I'm your host, Henry Arslanian, and welcome to this episode of the Future of Money podcast. Before we start, I want to say a big thank you to the 500,000 of you who follow my content each week. This podcast, The Future of Money, is now ranked in the top 5% of all podcasts globally on Spotify. Every week, thousands of you from over 160 countries globally are tuning in. So a massive thank you for all your support. It really means a lot, and to an entire team producing the Future of Money podcast. As all of you loyal listeners know, my goal with this podcast is very simple. It's to go deep in some of the biggest ideas, trends, and developments we are seeing in the field of crypto, and hopefully empower you with this information, and then let you make your own decision on what their impact can be on the future of money and the future of finance. And to do this, I invite each week one of the leading figures of the global crypto community to have this one-on-one conversation amongst crypto aficionados and discuss some of these topics. My guest today is Mr. Alessio Quaglini. He's the CEO and co-founder of Hex Trust. Before we jump right in, I have to say a couple things. First of all, our regular disclosures. Personally, I am an investor in Hex Trust, and many previous or current sponsors or companies I'm involved in are clients also of Hex Trust. So we just want to put the disclosure out there for transparency purposes. Alessio, welcome to the show. And one thing for all you loyal listeners, I mean, to show how dedicated Alessio is to the crypto industry, today is his birthday, and he still decided to come for this recording. So Alessio, happy birthday, and welcome to the Future Money podcast.
Thank you so much, Henry. My pleasure to be here, and congrats on the success of the podcast.
First of all, I know you're a big wine guy. How are you going to celebrate your birthday today?
I'm not sure. It's going to be a surprise, but the expectations are quite high. Because also, my wife is a sommelier, so let's see. Let's see what she has prepared for me.
Here we go. Wife sommelier, and you're a big wine aficionado. So, my God, that must be interesting on that perspective. We have a lot of interesting show today. I mean, I think for all the listeners on the show, we've been really trying to. There's been a lot of questions on what is the future of custody, self-custody versus centralized custody? What is going to be the future of staking services? And also some of the practical difficulties in building a custodian and whether custody services will become commoditized. So we're going to try to discuss all these topics today. Alessio, but before we jump right in, do you mind maybe giving a bit of background on yourself and also about Hex Trust? And then we'll dive into the questions.
Sure. Firstly, about myself. I'm Italian. I've been in Hong Kong for the past 15 years. By background, I'm an engineer, but I didn't really spend too much time in my career as a proper engineer, because I started working in the financial services industry early in my career. Actually, funnily enough, my first role in financial markets was working for the regulator, the securities regulator in Italy, where I was responsible of the supervision of intermediaries, especially in the market manipulation, insider trading, etc., where we were bringing stochastic models to understand the behaviors of investors and trying to detect market anomalies. After that, I joined a number of financial institutions until the end of 2017, when I met my co-founder, Rafał Czerniawski, through a common joint investment that we did in one of the startups here in Hong Kong. And we decided to do our own thing in the blockchain space. And that's when Hex Trust was born at the beginning of 2018.
And can you give a bit of summary on Hex Trust so we can get the audience can understand what Hex Trust is?
Yeah, sure. So Hex Trust was born, as I was mentioning, at the beginning of 2018. The idea was really to bring to the space an institutional platform and institutional service for custody of digital assets. Why did we want to do it? People tend to forget how different the market was 5 years ago from what it is now. It was mainly a retail space. There were no rules and regulations. There were a number of players that were operating from offshore jurisdictions. There was really little protection for investors, and hacks in terms of exchanges, etc., and were happening on a daily basis, right? So we thought, okay, here we have a new asset class, first of all, which is going to be very interesting from sell side and buy side. And at the same time, existing asset classes might be ported to blockchain in the future. So at a certain point, institutional investors will be very interested in entering the space. But to do that, they will need that kind of institutional protection and kind of setup that they are used to in the traditional space. that kind of setup that would avoid all those things that we have experienced in the last few years from happening in the space. So we said, okay, let's try to bring this kind of offering to the space and facilitate the entrance of institutional investors. We entered the space in 2018. We really entered the market with the first offering in the second half of 2019. By 2020, we were already quite established, especially in Asia. We did a couple of rounds of very successful financing. And as of today, we've basically become a global player with offices in 6 jurisdictions. So mainly we cover Asia, MENA, and Europe. We're licensed in all the jurisdictions where we have offices: Hong Kong, Singapore, Dubai, Italy. We just got a license in France and in the Bahamas. And we started by offering the core service of custody. And then we basically ventured into additional value-added services such as on-ramp, off-ramp, staking, access to trading venues, etc.
Let me focus on some of the things you just mentioned, Alessio. So, you know, if you ask many people in the crypto community, many people will tell you custody is becoming commoditized. It's going to be a service people will just offer, and it's very difficult to monetize custody unless you have some of these additional services on top. What do you think is the future of profitability of crypto custodians? I mean, do you think they will need to have these services on top, ancillary services, or that it's going to be custody by itself is a business model that has still a lot of future?
All right. So there's a couple of points here, right? So first of all, the commoditization of custody. So it is true that custody is a commodity in the traditional space, but in the crypto space, we're far from it, in my opinion. So the technology is evolving so fast. We have new blockchain protocols. We have new use cases. We have new business models. And custody is really at the core of facilitating and enabling these business models. So whatever custodians were doing 3 years ago, it is very different from what we are doing today. So I would say that, yes, probably at a certain point in the future, we'll have a more standard offering of custody. But as of today, from a technological perspective, we're really far from having from custody being a commodity. There's also a couple of aspects that are relevant to the how custody is evolving in the blockchain space. So the first one is obviously that in the traditional space, custody is basically a simple ledger where you record who owns what. Right. And then you transfer, I mean, you synchronize this ledger with the central depository institutions, et cetera. So assets in the traditional space, they're pure ledger entries. In the blockchain space, assets are basically smart contracts. It means that they are programmable, they're live animals, and some of the financial services are already enabled within the asset. So the asset is not a simple entry, but it has already embedded in the asset itself a number of services. And these services, they sometimes don't require an intermediary to enable them. They require the custodian to make sure that these assets can be used for those services. I'm talking, for example, about staking, right? You don't need anymore an intermediary to enable staking, right? You can do it directly from your custodian by signing a staking transaction on your assets, because that staking transaction is part of the protocol where the asset has been issued. So this is a very important difference from the traditional space, and it has an impact on how commoditized the service is and how you can monetize it. Now, going to the monetization, yes, obviously monetization is extremely complex, and I would agree with you that it's much harder to monetize a custody service versus a trading service or an exchange service, etc. However, the custody business brings a couple of advantages, right? So the first one is that it's a very sticky business, right? Which allows you to basically create some kind of barriers of entry or switching costs for your clients, and allows you to monetize your clients more in the long term versus other services. And at the same time, you're exactly right. So there are certain services that are enabled by custodians, right? And those services are much easier to monetize than the pure custody service. If we think about staking, it's one of the most profitable activities in today's market. And custodians really have the capability of capturing most of the monetization opportunity.
So let's talk about staking. I mean, you know, we're seeing now a rise of staking as a service, right? Where a lot of custodians are offering the service. Even a lot of crypto exchanges are offering, you know, staking services as well. And I mean, for many holders of certain crypto assets, whether it's Ethereum or other layer ones or layer twos, staking is actually a pretty good way to get a yield on that asset. But what's your view on staking as a service? Do you think in the next couple of years, we're going to see all the custodians offer staking services? And how difficult you think that is for a custodian to set that up?
All right. So staking is, I mean, as of today in the blockchain space, obviously proof of stake is the state of art, right? So it is obvious that staking is kind of this inflation protection mechanism, right? Similar to the overnight rate that we have in the traditional market, right? So we'll eventually have a kind of a staking yield that will be more or less aligned with the inflation that the protocol offers. So if the investor wants to protect itself against the inflation of the protocol, staking is the solution. So it is something that is here to stay until proof of stake would be the state of the art for blockchain protocols. Now, since you mentioned the exchanges, I think that it's very important to do a clarification between what staking is on an exchange platform, a centralized exchange platform, and what staking actually means for a custodian. If you're staking your assets via a custodian, it is very likely that you have your own segregated wallet. And it is very likely that the custodian is signing a staking transaction to allow you to delegate your funds to a node, a validator node in that specific blockchain protocol. This is exactly what staking is about. Whatever exchanges are offering today in the market is not staking, right? Exchanges are actually an anomaly in the blockchain market, an anomaly that eventually will have to be sorted out or solved. Yeah. So what exchanges offer is an omnibus account where all clients' funds are commingled. And when you press the button of staking, you're not actually staking. You're transferring your assets, the ownership, to the exchange via different types of contracts. For example, you're lending the funds to them. You're becoming an unsecured creditor to the exchange. Then the exchange would take these funds and they would decide what to do with them. They might decide to stake them. They might decide not to stake them. They might decide to use them for different purposes, as we have seen in a number of failures of platforms. So this is not staking. At best, is a collective investment scheme. And some regulators are actually correct in flagging that kind of activity should be a regulated activity. So blockchain, to conclude, blockchain has given us very important tools of creating wallets, of segregating assets, of tracking activities and movements of funds, and staking is a non-chain activity. So as a non-chain activity, it should be enabled in the correct way with segregated wallets, as it's been designed in all the blockchain protocols. And in this kind of shape and form, I think it is here to stay until we have proof of stake as the state of the art.
Yeah. It's a very interesting point, by the way, you mentioned on whether exchanges offering staking services could be considered a collective investment scheme, right? I mean, if as a user, you're giving your let's say, ETH to a certain exchange, who's then obviously just giving you the yield back, there's an argument to be done that was actually, it's a kind of mutual fund, it's a collective investment scheme. Unlike if it's really happening on chain, transaction where there is purely the service. I think this is the argument in some of the recent SEC cases between certain exchanges. We won't name them here, but this was the legal argument that was made from their general counsels at how the setup was different. But I think it's a very important point you mentioned on that side, Alessio. I just want to come back on the point of building a custodian, right? So obviously we discussed that many believe that custody could be commoditized at one point in the future. What is the most difficult part in building a custody business? What is the biggest challenge that you didn't anticipate when you start building Hex Trust that you think a lot of the traditional banks and other players are kind of underestimating as they get into their custody business setup journey?
All right. So I think there is one, to answer your question, I'll mention two at least. Yeah. So there's one general aspect of custody, which I think is the most important one, and it's security, right? As a custodian, we only have one shot, right? The first time that we fail to provide security to our clients and we lose clients' assets, we're done, right? So that is the core aspect, and that is where the majority of our attention, of our focus should actually be, right? And it's something that people take for granted, right? But it cannot be taken for granted, because we have a number of people that are investing a lot of money to find possible ways of breaching into our systems to take clients' assets. So this will always be the most important thing for us, to offer the highest level possible level of security. Now, in terms of the biggest challenge after security, it's actually something that, to be honest, I was not even expecting in 2017 when we were setting up the company. The market, as I was mentioning, was very different. We probably didn't even have proof of stake as kind of something that was really having traction in the market. The most challenging thing is that the technology that we need to provide is changing every day. The use cases, the business models that we need to support today did not exist before. So as of today, I'll give you some examples. Back in 2018, a couple of blockchains were the most important blockchains. Today, we need to support 30, 40 different protocols. On every single protocol, we have a lot of different token standards. It's not just ERC-20, but we need to support ERC-20, ERC-721, ERC-1155, and now new standards that are coming to the market, securities tokens type of standards. And this is not just for Ethereum. It can be for EVM compatible. It could be for Cosmos-based chains. So it makes the complexity exponential. Then you have bridges. So tokens can exist on different blockchains, so you need to bridge them seamlessly from one blockchain to the other. Then you have staking protocols, and every staking protocol on every single blockchain protocol functions in a completely different way, right? And then now you have Web3 connectivity. Who in 2018 was thinking about Web3 connectivity? The possibility of interacting with a variety of DeFi applications, of gaming applications, of metaverses, etc., and allow your users to connect the wallet and claim tokens and be able to interact, to sign blind transactions, etc., in a secure way. All of this, just to conclude, back in 2018, the standard was kind of cold wallets, the state of the art. Nowadays, it doesn't work anymore. You cannot connect your cold wallet to Uniswap and sign a transaction on time, right? So you need to provide the highest level of security, but you need to provide it in a very quick way, very efficient, and across different jurisdictions in a 24/7 way. So this is a very, very complex problem for custodians. And I want to highlight, I don't think we are at the stage where the service is commoditized at all, yeah? Lastly, just to conclude, probably we'll talk about it more later, but there's the whole elephant in the room of regulation. Every single country has a different framework and regulation. As custodians, we need to support global clients. So we need to understand how to comply with regulations across all the jurisdictions where we operate and where our clients operate.
So you raised so many good points, Alessio. I think we know whenever I have discussions with bank CEOs or boards, or often they tell me, yeah, we're thinking of getting in custody. But some of the elements you mentioned on security, the fast-changing technology, these are, as you know very well, as somebody who's worked in traditional finance for many years, it's very difficult for large financial institutions to get into, right? So often this is why I think that many of them are just investing or they look acquiring companies probably like yours just to actually be able to offer the service instead of them trying to build it, right? So that's a very, very interesting point of view there.
And I think, I mean, since you mentioned institutions and banks in particular, right? So we work with so many banks to try to understand what kind of offering they wanted to bring to the market. But I mean, the speed of change is really critical in this space. Banks do RFIs, RFPs. The average duration of this process is probably 2 years. By the time they have made a decision on how to go to market, basically, they have probably approved, okay, to do Bitcoin and Ethereum. And in the meantime, the last 24 months, the whole market has changed. And whatever they have approved is not relevant anymore to enable a profitable or competitive business model. So the speed at which traditional financial institutions and banks in particular operate is not aligned with what's happening in the market. So either the only ones that were able to go to market with something are the ones that really partnered up with providers or custodians, institutions in the blockchain space that are really expert in the space and they can move at the right speed.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's going to be one of the biggest challenges for any of the TradFi firms trying to enter the market for sure. You mentioned something, Alexio, that I want to touch upon. Obviously, as a custodian, you're offering services to a global client base. Regulation is a big topic, right? And you mentioned, obviously, you're active in Hong Kong, in Dubai, in Italy, France, and the Bahamas, other places. I mean, what are you finding is the biggest challenge in operating in a global environment with different regulators, especially when it comes from a custody perspective? Is that, you believe, a moat that gives you an advantage of others cannot enter as easily? Is it good because it gives a customer protection? Or it just becomes too confusing and basically nobody's really benefiting from it?
All right. So regulations are unfortunately still very different across different countries. Even tier one markets, they still have regulations that differ from each other quite a bit, right? Just to give you some examples, right? So we have a regulation in the UAE, in Dubai in particular, which is quite advanced, right? And defines very well the role of a custodian, right, versus the role of other intermediaries. At the same time, in Hong Kong, we know very well that we have a new framework, a regulation that only covers exchanges, right, and puts together the activity of a custodian only within the regulatory framework of exchanges. So we have, in other jurisdictions, custodians are not even regulated, right, but they only have to comply with basic AML CTF rules, right? So it is very different in every jurisdiction, and it makes our job quite difficult. However, I think there is a common denominator of rules that I would say apply across all jurisdictions, a basic set of standards and best practices that we believe that eventually will apply across all relevant jurisdictions where we want to operate. And we try to kind of use this common denominator across all jurisdictions and to be as compliant as possible. This sometimes doesn't make us competitive enough in certain jurisdictions, but I think it's a trade-off that we have to take if we really want to be competitive more in the long term rather than tactically.
Yeah, you mentioned Hong Kong regulations, actually. As a company that was Hong Kong native, and obviously I've known you for many years in Hong Kong as well, what do you think? Hong Kong obviously was a very big crypto hub back in the day. It had a little more difficult times, and now it's, you know, looking like it's making a comeback. What is your view on the rebirth of the Hong Kong crypto ecosystem, and particularly in contrast with other up-and-coming jurisdictions like Dubai and some European jurisdictions as well?
Yeah. So, well, I think Hong Kong is obviously a great place to be for a financial business in the blockchain space. It's a great place to be because it's one of the largest financial centers in the world. It's a hub of innovation. Shenzhen is right across the border, so we have access to lots of talent, a big talent pool, etc. There's also a lot of capital, right, which really helps in terms of when you want to provide financial services or becoming a relevant player in the space. It gives you access to huge markets, for example, to the mainland market, as well as the, I would say, the broader Asian market. So Hong Kong, in theory, is one of the best places to be to start at least a wholesale blockchain business, as well as retail if you have access to certain markets. Now, what happened is that lots of businesses were coming to Hong Kong, especially in the ICO boom phase, and the regulators tried to kind of reduce the risk for retail investors, right, by banning these type of activities and becoming a little bit more reluctant to accept crypto companies to operate in a completely unregulated environment. Lots of businesses left Hong Kong to find better places. And when I say better, it's places where they could operate without too much, as much supervision on one side, and on the other side, having clearer rules, which did not exist in Hong Kong. Why they come back? So now Hong Kong, for whatever reason, has decided to become a global hub for blockchain and crypto businesses. This means that the government, together with the regulators, are putting in place rules and regulations that allow companies to come back, to register themselves, and to operate legally under certain regulatory frameworks. Right? This is important because it gives you access to one of the, I would say, top-tier regulatory licenses, right? Recognized in top-tier jurisdictions, equivalent jurisdictions, as well as it gives you access to the traditional finance rails, right? Once you have the right license in Hong Kong, you'll be able to open bank accounts with banks and do business with traditional financial institutions, asset managers, pension funds, institutional brokers, etc. So this is a huge opportunity, right? Hong Kong saw that other jurisdictions that were slowing down, and they saw the opportunity to actually take back the business, to put in place a regulation and kind of step onto the stage and become the main player in Asia. I think this is happening. The first step, what they did was to regulate exchanges. In my personal opinion, they could have done more. They could have done better and regulate other types of intermediaries. But at the end of the day, it's a first step. More rules will come, and in other types of businesses, they will be able to regulate themselves and to get a proper license in Hong Kong and operate their business from here. It's a good first step, and we'll see more and more businesses coming here. I think as of today, in kind of Asia, Middle East, the only other place that is as attractive as Hong Kong is probably Dubai. So since Hextrust has licenses in both jurisdictions, I think we're really in a good place to operate our business.
Yeah, it's interesting as well. I think a lot of people that we speak to on the show, other places, it's always now like Hong Kong and Dubai coming up in the conversation, Abu Dhabi in certain cases as well. And then it's actually France, which is like, again, making comeback in a way on that perspective as well.
And we just got the license last week. So
here we go. Congratulations on that as well. Alessio, I want to ask one last question. We're already out of time, but I want to make sure I ask one more question on when it comes to, there's obviously post FTX, a lot of conversation around self-custody, right? And as a custodian, how do you see the future of the custody ecosystem? Will it be a place where centralized players will have a dominant role? Will it be one where self-custody will have a dominant role? Will it be a hybrid one or a mix of all of these?
I think this is the hardest question, is the $1 million question. What I see is that the regulated market will have regulated custodians, right? And these regulated custodians, they will have to register themselves as VASPs. They will have to comply with travel rule, etc. Once you comply with travel rule, kind of all the unregulated wallets and everything will face some difficulties in interacting with the regulated business. So I think in the short term, we'll see this kind of dichotomy between regulated businesses and the more unregulated self-custody type of activities. In terms of what, how the world will evolve more in the medium to long term, I think two things will have to coexist, and we will have tools to make sure that the two things can actually converge and interact with each other in a legal way, Yeah. What we can do from a custody perspective is to be, as I mean, adding one another layer of complexity, is to basically be as flexible as possible. So as a custody platform, as of today, we only allow custodial wallets. By the end of the year, we'll be able to provide our clients with the ability to set up custodial wallets where we are in full control of private keys, as well as self-custodial wallets where clients will operate wallets they, via our platform, but where they control the private keys of the wallet, as well as share custody models, which is a hybrid model where the private key is basically controlled in part by the custodian and in part by the client itself. So for us, it's basically enabling as many business models as possible to make sure that our clients can find the right solution for their business.
Excellent. Well, Alessio, we're going to go to our fire round of questions to finish off the show. My bell is with me today. So I'm going to ask you quick questions that I need a one or two word answer, basically. So it'll be very quick on that perspective, and we'll have some fun. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Let's kick it off. Alessio, you live in Hong Kong. What is your favorite thing to do when you're in Hong Kong?
Play tennis.
Oh, really? Here we go. Favorite tennis player of all time?
Roger Federer.
Difficult to disagree with that. Alessio, you're Italian. What is your favorite thing to do when you're back in Italy?
Eat pasta. And pizza.
What is your favorite Italian restaurant outside of Italy? Your favorite Italian restaurant that you recommend for people outside of Italy?
There's a very good pizza place here in Hong Kong called Fiata.
Yeah, of course. Well, here you go. Free advertisement for Fiat, you know. You're a wine guy, of course. What is your favorite type of wine that I think people underrate and do not give enough credit?
Trento DOC, Italian kind of champagne method, sparkling wine from the north of Italy.
Here we go. My God, the patriotism there. What is the downside of having a wife that is a sommelier?
Too much drinking.
Let's come back to work. What is the one skill you think is essential for any entrepreneur in crypto?
Persistence across throughout cycles.
Exactly. What is the one advice you give to anyone who wants to get into crypto? The one advice you give to anyone who wants to get into crypto?
Think it twice.
Think twice. I love it. Your nephew comes to you and says he wants to get into the crypto, become a crypto entrepreneur. He's debating between a couple of options to get some experience, working in investment banking, working at a regulator, working consulting, or just going and doing his startup. What do you recommend?
Do your own startup.
It was that.
Fail and then go and work for the regulator.
I love it. And Alessio, ready to finish it off on the show today, Alessio Quaglini, the CEO and co-founder of HexTrust. Alessio, if you could have lunch or dinner with one person dead or alive, who would you have lunch or dinner with?
My wife.
What a romantic man. That's the Italian side. Here we go. The sommelier wife was going to treat you on your birthday today. Well, Alessio, it was a pleasure having you on the show today. How can people find out more about you or learn more about HexTrust?
Well, I mean, hextrust.com is our website. Most of the information is there. And my Telegram, on-chain Panini. So very easy to remember. Feel free to contact me.
On-chain Panini. Again, the stereotypical Italian does it again. So Alessio, thanks for being with us on your birthday. Thank you, everybody who was on the show today. Hope you found the show useful. If you found it, again, please give us a 5-star rating. It really helps and more people discovering the show from that perspective. Thank you very much, everybody. And see you all next time for another episode of the Future of Money podcast. See you guys all soon.